You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
I'm really pleased to introduce to you Danielle Caron and Eric Mushloun. Danielle is currently the Librarian and Archivist of Canada. He's helped launch the Modernization Initiative to ensure that the Library and Archives of Canada can meet the multiple challenges of the digital environment. And Eric is a professor at the University of Montreal and a visiting professor at Harvard. He's the chair of the Intermedial Research Center on Letters, Arts and Techniques, as well as the Interdisciplinary Research Center on Emerging Technologies in Montreal, and we're really pleased to have them both. Welcome.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you very much, Amar, and thank you for being here. Thank you for the invitation to discuss this very important topic. You are an historian. You like archives, like many, many lawyers also like archives. Our biggest client is Justice Canada, obviously, in Canada. Just before I begin, just to say that all in every country, we're organized differently. So Library and Archives Canada is kind of a mix of Library of Congress with NARA, so your National Archives and Records Administration in Washington. And so there is no common theory around how to archive, how to select documents. So in the past, and that's what we're going to discuss today, it was appropriate and convenient. More and more with internet, it's difficult, and we need to go back to our drawing boards and probably develop new approaches. So, and this is my starting point, so which is where we were at in the analog world. So, I like to call it the human expression. So, there are many ways: artists, writing, photographs. So, there are many ways to express ourselves in society. And this contributes to the big conversation, the societal discourses in every country and internationally. So until, I would say, probably 20 years ago, the way the material that we have in our archives and libraries was coming to us was through several filters. So everybody expressed itself in a certain way. We leave traces or not. And when there were traces, so we had to wait in archives and libraries so that those traces come to us. And so we were going through them and deciding, is it going to be relevant? Is it going to be useful? Or should we just say, well, we let it go? So these filters put us in a position where, in fact, we were quite comfortable, I would say, waiting for material to come to us and do the selection after. So our role, and that's the important point, used to begin at the moment material was coming to us. So through legal deposit, for instance, when it comes to publications, and also through various protocols used in organizations on how to document activities, decision-making in the government or any private enterprises. So this is quite changing. My observation is that the writing system is crumbling. So all these conventions that we used to rely upon are just falling apart because of the digital environment we're in. So the publishers don't play that role as they used to play. And we have, in fact, at University of Montreal, there is a guy there who is looking at the number of novels, poems, that are produced on the web without a legal deposit number. It's humongous. And so it escapes us because we don't see that unless we're on the web searching for it. So we don't even know it exists, but it's part of, in our case, Canadiana. So we should be grabbing that material. But to know that it exists, so we need to develop new tools so we can work upstream. I'll come back to that. But this is just an example. The other thing we have observed also, even in governments and in enterprises, in businesses, so we used to have documentation standards. So, one note to file, I like to say, is this is the first thing you teach to a young public servant, is that when you make a decision, when you take a decision, so you put a note to file. It's with Twitter, with Facebook, what we see is a lot of people now are using those new social media tools to make decisions and to write also important material, scientific material, and so they don't necessarily document, they don't necessarily safeguard the way we used to do on paper in a file. So it's somewhere in the cloud. So the documentation standards, the documentation protocols are evolving too because of all of these new tools that we have around us. Three impacts of the digital that are quite visible on at least three fronts. So first of all, here comes everybody. Obviously, what I showed you before, so this filtering that was making the volume of production more masterable is now gone. So everybody produces, everybody leaves traces everywhere. So there is no mediation between the traces and what comes to us or what should come to us. The second point is what we see also is that there is fewer official interventions in the organization of traces. So we used to have record archival description methodologies, we have the Dewey system for the librarians, and more, what we see is that people don't want this material to be organized that way. We have an example in Canada, there is a public library in Markham, Ontario, that has developed its own system. Now it's called the Treacy, and you go there and it's like going to chapters. So it's organized so people come and it's by topic. That has nothing to do with Dewey system. It's a totally different environment. People get in, it's leisure, it's recipes, and you see those big titles and you go where. So that's quite different. But that's the way they keep people coming to them. So that's what they explained to us last year when we visited them. That's quite interesting also. And it creates, obviously, some problems too. And the third area is obviously access that is more direct and less mediated. People are using search boxes, search tools that are electronic, and they don't necessarily want to talk to someone behind a counter. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but this is what's happening. So, and I've said to the librarians in Canada once, so it's no longer going to happen behind a counter, but probably you need to move somewhere on the web to help people to find their material. So, the three main factors, according to me, that are behind this change. First of all, the exponential growth in literacy. So we've observed, obviously, that people now, since after the Second World War, I would say a lot more people are reading, writing, and producing documentary, eventually heritage, as you said, so that can become part of our heritage. There is also the new capacity enabled by technology. So the possibilities are endless. And finally, the digital has a major impact on human behavior in terms of perceptions, in terms of what people can expect from life. So we see that. And also, it's changing. I remember one thing I read that happened in Belgium. This guy was driving at 300 kilometers per hour on a highway, having his friend with his BlackBerry filming the dashboard. And so he put it on the web. So thinking that, you know, he's at the tavern and talking to the friends, hey, I ran up. So there were two of this type of cars in Belgium, so they found him. And that's the type of things that, you know, it's changing our behaviors, it's changing our expectations, perceptions in life, immediacy and all these things you're familiar with, I'm sure. So as literacy and technological capacity has increased, what we see, we go from relatively meaningful and understandable material to noise. So more and more. So what I'm trying to show you there is the fact that we had something coming to us that was understandable, that was authoritative, and now we're lost. There is a lot out there. And how do we select all this material? And I found this very interesting picture on the web that illustrates very well what I mean. So going from meaningful traces not only to noise but to an awful din. So for us, in the past, we were in the first image. So we were receiving something understandable. But as the information produced is, you know, an exaflood, is super abundant. So for us, we're in the last one now. So it's coming to us, and we don't know how to do the triage, how to be selective about this material, what's authoritative, what will be of importance to historians, to writers, to genealogists, so all the usual suspects, and also to make the state functioning, because a lot of the information produced that is in the archive is in support of our society. So I think this is probably the biggest, the major issue that we are facing now is to be in that environment where we need to find ways of replacing the traditional mediation that came through us through the documentary protocols and publishers, for instance. So, how do we get the message back? Issues, challenges, and opportunities for us as the National Archives. I think we need to refocus our attention on the causa materialis, which is the fundamental production of documents that is of importance for the functioning of the state and society. So as a programmed activity, and Eric is probably going to talk about what also will be left somewhere and will discover in 50, 60 years, that's fine, but we need a minimum. And the role of the National Archives, obviously, is to focus on having this minimum of information that will make us function in future and make sure that our culture also is traveling from generation to generation. Because now occupying the web is more and more important if you want the people to be influenced by what you've been developed as a country. Public policy approach grounded in epistemology, I think we need to have something, and what I mean there is research-based evidence. We used to begin our work as librarians and archivists after the fact, after the documents were coming to us. Now we need to link it more and more, and we need to do research on this. So what is motivating the creation? How is it happening? More and more we need to understand how it's happening upstream so we are able to develop the tools that will help us to document society in a good way. So we have developed, I'm putting there All of Society, because we are developing an approach in Canada which is called All of Society based on social theory. So we're looking at the discourses, starting with Foucault, and saying, okay, what are the conversations in Canada now? So we had one, Idle No More, you may be aware of. It's the Aboriginal people protesting. And so how do we document this thing? So and instead of waiting, so we're going to work, scan the environment, look at who is producing what. So yes, there will be books in 20 years, in 10 years maybe, but for sure now there are blogs, there are newspapers that are producing information, there is the government producing information, so we're trying to document that way. So that's the whole of society approach that we are building and testing. I think we need also to go from objects to content in context. So we used to collect. Less and less we'll be able just to focus on collecting. We need to be able to work upstream and again identify how the conversation is going through what type of media. So because there are several media, and so we need to take them into consideration. So we need to go from acquiring and collecting to identifying and documenting. So we're trying to document society. In the past, we were more collecting objects. Now we need to document society. So for historians, I think it's a great opportunity because now we can have the opinions of a lot of people. What we didn't have in the past, when I did my own dissertation on Aboriginal issues, there was one voice in the archives that I'm now reading. And this voice was the voice of the state. I mean, because the Aboriginal people have an oral tradition, so we had nothing. Now this oral tradition is on the internet. People are blogging, they're talking. So we can have not only the voice of the state, but also the third sector, the other players, and also some sampling of the citizens. So what are they saying about this issue that we're facing? So that's quite interesting because it gives us a better representation, and that's what I meant by relevant in the title. So it's a bit provocative, but I don't think we can build a relevant past, but we can have certainly something that is more representative of what was that past, so we can write history and whatever, you know, using the entire view of that past. So going from objects related mediation, so we used to transfer books, to transfer a font, a manuscript, a document, to ontological and evolving descriptions to reflect lexicon use in society. Just a quick example on that. All our descriptions in archives are done the year it's coming in, so we're looking at it. So we have a very good example in Canada where if you go to our website and you look for trains or railways, you won't find a lot because it is classified as surface transportation. That was the terminology used in the 50s, 60s. So the kids now are not using that vocabulary. It's like another one is recipes. So we don't use recipes in our description. We use cookery books. Not very popular. So we need to have, and that's another challenge that we have, I think, if we want to stay relevant and have our material found. It's something to digitize and to put it on the web. We need to make sure that it's findable also using the right vocabulary. So there is a lot of work to be done there. And preservation, to me, it's going to be preservation in the cloud of material of enduring value. So some kind of technological inoculation of the important material, the material of enduring value, so against disappearance or destruction. But I think we're not going to be able soon to grab everything and to bring it. That's an old conception. I think it's going to stay in the cloud, but we're going to inoculate, so we're going to preserve where it is in its context, and so we can have access to it over time. Voilà. Conclusion, in doing this, in my view, don't we have an opportunity to build documentary holdings that will be a better reflection, so more representative of our past? And obviously, there's a lot of research that is needed. There are many aspects, economical aspects, legal aspects, technological aspects that will need to be tackled to move into that direction. But it's extremely important that we start thinking about it, because all this work used to be taken for granted for many, many years. And now this environment is really shaking our traditional practices. Eric.
Thanks. Well, I'm going to try to tackle the same issues, but from a different perspective. I'm not an archivist or a librarian, so of course I have another point of view. And mind where to go?
It's not a digital screen, huh?
Yeah.
So okay. Okay. So let me play with it when you speak,
yeah,
and I'll find it for you.
What I'd like to do is to try to raise a few issues, sometimes general, but starting from a few observations and even numbers. And I think that they fuel actually exactly what Daniel has just said to you. You need...
No, I won't be able to do that, so I don't know how to...
Can we see?
But we can't...
We cannot go there.
Oh, the cursor won't take it.
The technician in the room.
Yes.
Hello.
Yeah, I don't know how this
works. I think the cursor is the red button.
Ah, okay, maybe that's... Okay, got it. Yeah,
there we go.
Okay, yeah. Here we are. Thank
here
you.
We are. Okay, and beginning maybe with a few definitions. We have archivists here, librarians, so that's something you know perfectly well, but for people who are not familiar to the what an archive is or how it was conceived, two short definitions, and I try to emphasize a few items which looked obviously quite important as far as archives are concerned. The first one is that it should be a kind of something mechanical or even organical. So archives are a body of records regardless of medium or format that automatically increases in size owing to the activities of private individual or public corporation. Or another definition by a historian, the distinguishing feature of archives is that they are cumulative like sediment. So this kind of organic way or organic understanding of what archives are. And so it's not only what they deliberately choose to remember, but everything else as well. So everything could be, right, maybe should be, an archive. And that's quite problematic as far as the new digital environment we're in is concerned, because we have an extraordinary inflation of documentary activities. To give just a few numbers, so in 2010, corporations stored something like 7 exabytes of data, individuals 6, so 13. And to give you an idea of what it means, 13 exabytes is, as you see, 130,000 times the Library of Congress. So it's absolutely crazy, and it's quite obvious that we just can't manage to deal with such a mass of information. So we have to do something, and it's quite obvious that this idea of something automatic, where everything can be and should be an archive, is something that we have to forget. So if we want to forget it, what are we going to do? And it's not only that we have to forget that, it's also that we can't have the idea that maybe in the cloud there is a technical device where we would be able to have everything somewhere. And it's true that we could have the feeling that it's possible, and it's probably technically possible. But it's not a matter only of technology. And technology can help us, and it helps us a lot, but it doesn't help us to know what knowledge, or what is knowledgeable. It gives us data, but that's very different. So we have here two different kind of inquiries, one from the British Library and the one from David Rosenthal, who has created LOX in Stanford, and both of them are saying exactly the same thing in a very short period, and that's quite important. It's not in 15 years' time. It's now or after tomorrow that we won't be able to keep everything. From purely economical point of view. So if it is so, we have to try to forget or to avoid this kind of organic illusion of the activity, how the archives was usually conceived as a kind of automatic recording, and try to emphasize not this a kind of organism, but actually an organization, and understanding archives as a technical, cultural, and social organization of the past, by two ways, which are quite classical, and every archivist here knows them perfectly well: appraisal and ordering the possible retrieval. So appraisal is precisely how you decide what you're going to keep and what you're going to just erase. And part of what an archivist do is, contrary to what usually one thinks, what an archivist do is it does is actually to erase a lot of things in order to keep the relevant past precisely, and in a way to constitute it. And it's part of his job, and to know exactly, or try to anticipate, for how long we would need it. Some documents we would need it, we'd need them for 10 years, maybe, other ones for 50, and other ones for, well, the eternity, if we can. And so it's a matter of decision. But of course, it's quite difficult to understand how to make this kind of decision in a relevant way with the maximum of security in order to keep most of the important archives and even sometimes apparently not important, but which could be of some importance in the future. So that's something part of the job, of course. And in appraisal, you understand that there is something like praise. So you give value to someone in praising it. And it's part of the job as well as the ordering, the classification, how you can, after having selecting it, be able to retrieve it, find it. So you have here a kind of, with the format it has changed, but it's, of course, But you have to think about a controlled amnesia. And it could be, again, a bit of provocation to say, well, we need to forget. It's absolutely indispensable for us to forget. Memory is working precisely because we are able to forget things. Otherwise, it's just a mess, like the figure you showed us. So we have to have amnesia, but a controlled one, meaning that precisely we have to think about how to produce meaning and how to create value. Producing meaning and creating value, that's what an archivist is now able to do or should do. And that's how his work should be understood. So two problems here for this understanding of the new job of archivists and librarians. Preservation and access. Preservation because we have now, and that's of course one of the main problems with the digital environment we're in, variability of records and moreover an obsolescence and a very, very quick obsolescence of softwares and computers. And so it's quite obvious we are able probably to keep almost everything, but as you know, we have to read the data. And if in 5 years or 10 years time we haven't the right software or the right computer which could work, well, the data are just impossible to read. That's it. And we all of us have done this kind of experience of having files we are not any longer able to read. So, of course, we have technological ways of dealing with this issue by migration, which assures a kind of continuity of content, or by emulation, continuity of access this time, and of course we can do it. But that's something which is done downstream. But as Daniel tried to emphasize, we need to work upstream as well, and it's probably far more important. So we need to think about access before thinking about preservation. And again, this kind of weird way of thinking about archives, because the usual way was what you said. It's we're collecting things, and then we try to evaluate and keep what is supposed to be needed, and then we try to think about how to make it accessible. But it's exactly the reverse that we need now, precisely because retrieval is more important than the preservation as such. I don't mean that we shouldn't care about preservation, of course. We must care about it. But access is really something quite important, and moreover, to think about it from the very beginning. So classification, automated search, and we can try to think about algorithms even before we tend to try to collect and classify everything. So it's this reversal which is needed now, which means that archiving is now less kind of a way of guarding a kind of treasure, a national treasure or national heritage as such, but a kind of document architecture. It's a matter of how to construct, to build up these archives. And it should be also conceived as kind of technical assistance to producers themselves, to tell them from the very beginning, well, that's how you should conceive what you're producing as data or information, in order for them to be able to make some knowledge and relevant knowledge from the start, and so that archivists would know exactly what to do with what they can collect or receive, which means that archival holdings, we need to think about them as an institution, and as any kind of institution, it's transforming things, and here it transforms, well, we could say, living memories or even living perceptions into certified records, and the important term here is less record than certified. We need to have kind of authentication of documents, or facts into events, and that's not the same thing. When you we accumulate massive number of facts, but all of them are not events, what we would call an event. So that's exactly what the institution does. Or information into documents. Information as such doesn't say anything about the world. It just says, I'm here. You have to decipher me and make me something knowledgeable. That's what is a document. We could, in order to understand it maybe better, have an example with three ways, social ways of understanding what archives are, how they were produced in tradition, in culture, or in our digital environment. Think, for example, of a church. Think about this church as a kind of document of a certain past, with the rituality and a certain religion and so on. In Europe or in America, probably if we have an old church almost crumbling down and on the verge of disappearing, vanishing, we try to preserve it as such, as a ruin. But because this ruin is important for us, it means something. So we want to preserve the materiality of this content. But in traditions, not at all like that. In traditional societies, you certainly can have a ritualistic aspect of whatever thing. Take a temple, a Japanese temple. What usually is done in Japan with old temple, ancient temple, it's not at all when there are when they begin to be too old to be really used and become dangerous for people, they raise it and they build it up again with new materials, but with a traditional way of building it up. And that's the important thing. If it's if the form itself, the way it was built, is again recreated, that's the right way to do it with it. So it's not the materiality of content which is preserved, it's a regularity of form, quite different. And in my mind, in the digital environment, it's a kind of mixture of both. Again, it's not the materiality of content because precisely we are able to have different softwares and dealing with different formats, and then we certainly not keep the materiality itself of the content, but we have nevertheless an authenticated content, something certified by its regularity, and that's what we should keep in mind. So to in order to conclude with a few general elements. It's quite interesting to see how archives, which were always in the plural for a long time, we talk about archives and we need this plural, is more and more understood now as a singular, the archive, it's as if it's such a general issue now that it needs this kind of the generality of the singular, the archive. And what is the archive? Well, I would say that it's a mode of existence of groups of statesmen. I try to keep it as general as possible, as you see. So sorry for the abstract way of dealing with it, but I think it's sometimes important to have this kind of abstraction. So a mode of existence, but also a means of insistence, if I can play a bit on words here. Insistence making elements of the past appear in the present. And this appearance in the presence, in the present, is something quite important, and we need to think about it as a presentation, the active way of presenting something. And that's part of the appraisal and the way of show the value and the meaningfulness of the documents. And it's possible to do it with operations of discourse, and we find again the idea of social discourses, but the institution deals with operations of discourse. The possibility of reciting these sources, evidences, and so on for individual or collective memories. It's also a matter of legitimation, and that's where probably legal issues are at stake here, and a way to preserve a group, the identity of a group over time, and that's where value and meaning again appear. So that's why I think the issue of archives and archival practices are no longer a matter of specialists. They are, of course, as still are. It's important that they still are. But it's also a social issue. And that's why researchers who are not archivists and or librarians have to enter in the picture, so to speak, and try to understand what's going on now, because we are, with the digital environment, in a very important and very interesting turning point, so to speak. Thank you.
I was wondering that there must be some international organizations that are dealing with this big problem of archive and access and exchange, like the International Standards Organization in Geneva or other.
There is the International Council of Archives, so yes, we are working together, but since we're coming from all, everybody has a different setup institutionally, so it's very difficult. So we're all conscious, so we've started to, and I'm chairing the Forum of National Archivists, so within this International Council, and we have meetings every year to focus on three or four issues. So one is obviously the how do we acquire, so this, what Eric was also talking about, so the appraising issue. One is preservation and one is access. So there are many, many organizations also that are working on transparency issues internationally, so that are interested in this type of issue. But I think that what we are both saying today is that the focus has been downstream on accessing, making things. So make sure that we have access to everything, but what is that everything? What is becoming the archive in the current digital environment? And that's the major question. This is why we need to move upstream and start asking different set of questions, and that's difficult. That's not in the tradition. So what Eric was saying, that we need to have a new specialist invading the field, working with archivists and librarians, I think it's going to be extremely necessary and very productive. So because we need to look at it differently. It's no longer just a matter of organizing material. It's also a matter of selecting. And selection for historians or for... This is a very sensitive, touchy question. Yeah.
Can I ask you to elaborate...
No, that's you and then... Yeah.
Okay, could I ask you to elaborate a little bit on your comment about sort of archiving in the cloud? Because one of the things that Clifford Lynch has said very carefully, and that I've seen in my own experience, is that if you don't have an institution involved, digital stuff is ephemeral, and unless somebody's paying attention, it will disappear before we acquire it. And it takes, and going towards the idea of a society, in society we organize ourselves into institutions to do things of that kind, to make things endure. So can you say a little bit more about what you're
Absolutely.
Talking about in the cloud?
Yeah, and I think it has to be under the responsibility of an institution,
yeah,
this inoculation. But what I mean is that it's going to be more and more difficult just to harvest everything and bring it under a roof.
Yeah.
So what we used to do is to protect it. So we used the analog material is all in our vaults, and we're very proud of it, and we take care of it. Now it's going to be a matter of making sure that we can inoculate it somewhere, so to make sure that it doesn't disappear, but may have to stay there. But
yeah,
under the responsibility of an institution, it has to be. Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree with that, absolutely. But it's the way we're going to, because now we still have this analog reflex of trying to grab everything and bring it under the roof of the National Archives. I think it's going to be more and more difficult if we want to there are also a lot of rights issues.
Yes.
In fact,
yeah,
we're doing it now. We're harvesting the web surgically with this whole of society model, and we get into some issues.
Yes.
So the blog of this journalist, can we really take it? Or we can just identify and inoculate it? So that's...
How is this inoculation working?
Well, no, we need technological solution to help us to do that,
yeah,
but we need to protect it,
mm-hmm,
where it is, probably. Yeah, exactly. So, no, there is a lot to be done before we can inoculate.
Okay.
No, I agree. Yes.
I want to pull this down from the abstraction level down toward concrete. So let's take an example. Used to be if you wanted to archive train schedules, you would have the railroad company send a copy to your archive every month, and you would file it away. Now maybe there's no longer a printed schedule at all, and all it is a database. All it is a website, you know, with PHP and MySQL tables sitting behind it. And how do you archive that from externally, so you don't have, you know, some access into the place that's producing that data? And if you don't, that may seem like trivial data, but that could be pretty important for quite a variety of reasons any number of years into the future.
Yeah. No, that's a very good question. And what we have implemented into... there are two parts to this question. First of all, when it comes to government institutions, so we have a better... We can influence a little bit more.
Let's pretend the train company is not part of the Canadian government.
No, if it's not part of the train... Yeah, so can it be regulated under some kind of a regulation? If it's important, so we need to have a means by which we're going to influence the documentation protocols. That's what we are after. So we need to have documentation protocols that we accept in society. We have developed a record-keeping directive in Canada just for the government. So I'll not go after the for outside of the government. But where we are asking every department by 2015 to have developed their documentation standards. So they need to tell citizens, and this is transparency, more than having access to whatever you produce, is the documentation protocols. That means you're telling citizens what you are documenting and how you're documenting your activities. So they have to have it in place, and so from there we keep them. Now, when you go outside of government, if it is in a totally unregulated activity, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. But Sarbanes-Oxley is a good example, so where you've started to influence how the private sector is documenting its own activities. And there was an article in The Atlantic lately, I think it's last month or 2 months ago, saying that the banks are producing a humongous amount of information, but it's not the right information, because the documentation protocols are not yet sufficiently clear on what is needed to be informed in the current society. But without this type of intervention, I mean, you're going to have what Eric and I were discussing, the vestige, so the rings that you're going to find eventually going into a cloud somewhere and finding some information, but without having the assurance that you're going to get those trains scheduled.
Related to that,
I was struck by the fact of the distribution of the data produced. Was that only last year, I think? Like 7 exabytes,
yeah.
Corporations. And or does that also include like government institutions or
yeah,
only private? Uh-huh, okay. And then 6 exabytes or so like individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that points to the fact that, you know, contrary to like, you know, dominant beliefs that, you know, the internet is sort of a source of democratization and all of that, there's a danger involved here. Like the data produced is not like everybody is putting up a blog And it feels like it maybe, but when you look at the overall numbers of data, there are certain bigger players in this game. And sort of coming back to your point, I think we need some kind of regulation, not only of the government institutions, but also of the corporations and banks and all other data producing institutions to have access to this kind of information. And sort of similarly to the analog, and there are things in place, like when it's relevant for a court case or so, people have to, you know, give out the material. And I think that's important to continue that into the digital age. I don't know what you think about sort of the democracy factor in all of this data wealth.
Yes, well, it's a fantastic issue and quite an important one. It's quite obvious that if you take, for example, the agreement between Twitter and the Library of Congress, they decided to collect every tweet tweeted in the States since 2006. It's massive. And it's great. They say that it's part of the national heritage. And historians in 10 years or time or 50 years' time would be quite interested in understanding what's going on here, this new means of communication, who is saying what to whom, and so on. That's great. One of the problems is that it's almost impossible to get access to them because there are too many. So it's there a matter of retrieval and accessibility. And if democracy means we keep everything that is said in the public, it sounds great. But actually, it isn't. Because precisely, there's no appraisal. There's no way of understanding the production of those tweets. And how to select them and how to search them. So if you want to search for specific things, well, it takes a very long time. And there are always technological issues, and you can say, well, we are going to improve it. And it's true. I'm sure it will be improved, but not as much as the volume, the mass of the information we have. So we have to tackle the issue in a very different way, I think. That's why this illusion of automaticity, kind of just pure organism growing and growing up constantly, doesn't work at all. And if we want to have real democracy, we precisely have to make choices. That's what democracy is about, and not keeping everything.
I think we're more and more finding out that quantity is not quality. This is the article in The Atlantic, and this is also something, just briefly, a short example that we had to go through in Canada some years ago, around 2000, with what we call the Gomery Commission, what was some kind of a political scandal, and so they did a commission of inquiry. And then at the end, one of the main conclusions from the commissioner was that he had 23.5 million documents to look at. But he didn't find what he was looking for in those 23.5. So it was massive, but not the right stuff. So one of the recommendations was to move into some kind of improving documentation protocol within the administration. So we could find, you know, decisions made and, you know, some traces of the important stuff. That's what you're saying. So the quantity is...
You have a massive increase of data. And you also have a massive increase of appraisers who look at that data. That is, somebody writes an article about some scientific thing, and then somebody else looks at it and says, this is wrong. And often the people who are interested are the specialists in that particular thing. And I'm wondering if there's any, not wiki exactly, but some kind of lessons that can be taken from the wiki, especially with respect to sorting, because... you say data is growing so rapidly, but there is this other thing that is growing as well, which is people who want to through and are,
yeah, some kind of crowdsourcing
are vitally interested
or,
in
yeah.
particular area.
I mean, what we're doing internally is we're building those teams, those network. I think it's collaboration will be essential in the coming years. So it's not something, Eric, you mentioned that, yes, we need more people, more to look at it from different angles. And so I think we need to build that. But we also need to work in networks more than ever to be able to tackle this appraisal issue. And so the whole of society, the way we're building it, and it's just we're just starting to do that, is that we're connecting researchers across the country that are specialists in different teams. We call them domains. So, and they will help us to identify the conversations, so the discourses, and also to tell us, well, this is important or this is less important. So we cannot do it alone from inside because we would need an army of people. So we need to do it with those who are really participating. As you said, so the specialist, the expert in the field, and so connect them with us to help us to identify what's happening here and what's important, what is valuable. So that's going to be the model that will have to take place. And so we're building it slowly, but I think it's the future. Collaboration.
Or is it better just like when you clean up your incoming email, you just leave it for a while and then go back and it's easier to see what's relevant and what's not? Or does it help to...
That's the issue.
...sorting out as it comes in?
Part of the answer will have to come from software companies. So we need to work, and I've discussed it with, in fact, your national archivist, David Ferrario. So we need to influence the software company to develop some kind of functionalities. When you create a document, you're the creator, so you know a little bit more than anybody else about what you're writing. You should be able to scroll down the menu. So for 24 hours, it's the invitation to a dinner, up to, although in some offices it may be important, but up to enduring value, historical value. So, and then you scroll down and it should go in a bin somewhere and be preserved for the time you have identified. If you wait, chances are the cloud is moving, as you see. So there may be nothing. And to come after the fact and look at a hard drive is not something that can be done like we used to take a couple of boxes of paper and going through them. So it's a lot more complex, more difficult. And it's, what's his name, Jonathan Zittrain, in fact, who said there is quite a distinction between safeguarding and preserving. So we safeguard a lot, but we don't, and you alluded to it, so we don't necessarily preserve it properly. So, which means to make sure that it's going to be readable and accessible in 5-10 years from now. And it's probably closer than what you think. I remember going to a committee in Parliament and explaining to people, go in your basement and open your old 3, 4, 5 years computer and try to read the files you had supposedly preserved. You're going to see it was probably safeguarded. You're going to have difficulties reading them with the new software. So it's those are major issues that we didn't have in the paper world.
What kind of support are you getting, and what do you see the future like in terms of how much money it's going to take?
Well, I think it's for now it's intellectual capital, so that is needed. So we need to rethink our approaches. It's not necessarily to go with a huge investment in technology, and Eric is working with us also, and we have a network of universities helping us. I think it's more intellectual capital, how to address this issue before we invest in technology. But the technological solution sometimes will be very simple, like the scroll-down menu, in fact, for organizations that are regulated and that have to have documentation, documentary protocols. If we are able to implement these software, so it's not very complicated. So it's, I don't know how down the road it's going to be, it may become very expensive. But for now, it's more to rethink and to make people, and as Eric said very well at the end, so it's a social issue now, more and more than ever. If we want to have something in future, in fact, to chew on it for historians, genealogists, or even for the state to be able to proceed with its law case and other stuff.
this.
How do you balance the cost of storing content against the cost of deciding what to store? I know some instances you can spend more deciding whether to keep something that it would cost to just store everything.
Yeah. Total cost of ownership. It's it is something, in fact, that was not necessarily taken into consideration in the analog world, not too much because it was contained. This is something that is now more and more part of the discussion, but we haven't yet answered that question. But it's becoming an issue. In fact, the Library of Congress, with its archiving of all the tweets, has faced some limitation because there are costs to it. We've, in Canada, tried to, in fact, we did it twice, to harvest the .ca. Huge expenses, and to keep it after, because it's something to just, sorry, to, the .ca, the Canadian domain. And so it was huge. And at the end, so it's something you can even put it on a server, but what do you do with it? I mean, it needs to be worked and you know, to be able to make it accessible. So it's something that is in fact influencing the approaches we're developing. So to make sure that we will keep what is essential, and we're not going to keep, you know, everything. And the other issue that in fact we both alluded to is the fact that this material will have always to be emulated in a certain way for its vocabulary and indexation and description. So when you have it, it's not the end of it. It continues forever. So you need to continue to if you want to make it accessible. Yes?
I was wondering if you could say something a little about the nature of collaboration going ahead. I mean, obviously, with so many things, I mean, how does that play into who collects what and how it's done, and how it's really coordinated in a long term? I mean, in terms of cost, I assume that may be part of the solution. I mean, sharing the burden of how we do this, but it's like a larger worldwide collaboration, right?
Yeah, it is a big issue. Personally, as the head of Library and Archives Canada, what I'm doing is I'm focusing on what is of national significance. So I put in place a committee of national significance. People looking at what is of national significance. We have provincial archives, local archives. In total, we have 2,400 libraries and 800 archives, and you have more in the States, a lot more. My role is, in my mandate, is to make sure that what is of national significance will be acquired and preserved. So I'm focusing on it, counting on others to focus on their own provincial or local or municipal or private mandate. But that's how, I mean, we have no authority. Nobody has an authority on others in these domains. So you try to, you know, work together. And at the end of the day, I mean, we're all responsible for our mandate.
That's also a little bit with the potential problem of bias in the selection, right? So that if you know that you're not going to be able to collect everything, so you're going to decide that only things that are appraised and found to be of value are going to be collected, then you run the risk of having a political bias or a, you know, class bias or whatever. And it sounds like you're sort of hoping to avoid that a bit with this distributed model as well.
Yeah, but this is why, in fact, what you were alluding to, so to having more people helping us to do that work, to identify what is of importance, so should neutralize and make it as objective as it can be, representative, I like to say, in fact. So all the voices are there, but you need to do it in collaboration. You cannot decide no, because you'd be, in fact, focused. But we've done it in the past without knowing. But now there is, I think we have an opportunity to be even more open, more representative. Mm-hmm. But as long as we open also the conversation with those outside of the institution who can help us to identify what is of importance in a domain, right, what's being said. I think it's a great opportunity, but, you know, it needs to, as you said, in fact, we need to bring new disciplines, new social scientists, for instance, to help us to scan the environment. And it's a different approach, mm-hmm, totally different.
So with respect to the strategy that you have in administering Library and Archives Canada,
I think the question that we should be asking sooner rather than later is with respect to the strategy in the digital arena, what's the role of the analog artifact? So do you see, in terms of a future strategy, do you see an ongoing obligation to be custodians of the analog past? And if so, you're nodding your head yes, then this, I think it begs the question, on another level of staff knowledge and technology, it's a big challenging question of integration, isn't it? So with respect to a query that you have on the past, if we don't have the money or if we don't have the mandate to put everything into digital form, how do we prepare ourselves to integrate and communicate the analog and the digital together?
So yes, obviously we are. And in fact, in my orientation document in 2009, I used the verb, I said we're condemned to work in both worlds. Yeah. And referring to Plato, I like to refer to Plato because when we started to write, Plato was against it, but we haven't stopped talking. Right. So we still talk, we write, and then we're digital, and which is a mix of... yes, we need to do both. And in terms of skills, yes, it's a challenge. So we're trying to develop approaches and policies that are format agnostic, if I may say. So that's the language we're using internally. So as much as possible. But when it comes to preservation, obviously, a manuscript, a rare book, needs specific expertise. So we're keeping both, and that it's going to be like that. Because to me, digital is totally different than digitization. So you can digitize your material, but you need to keep the analog. I mean, we're not going to digitize the Constitution and shred the original. So we're going to keep. So and we need to continue to work in both ways, and what's coming after, I don't know.
What organizations might do is digitize things and then say, as a matter of policy, we won't make this previous version available to use in public and public access anymore. So back to the previous question about democratization of access and what's considered to be the authorized version.
We have a three level access policy, and yes, the more like we have Aboriginal treaties, for instance, that need to be seen by the parties once in a while. So yes, we're providing access to researchers, university researchers. So there, this access still and will continue forever, accessing the original documents, because some people need to see the original document. The digitization is for le grand public, so the mass people that are just, they want to have access to their heritage. And they're satisfied with what they see on the wall. This is interesting, and they go for the content, but they don't need to work with the original and see maybe some other aspects of the manuscript of the documents. So we need to keep that. That's I think it's this is part of the job.
It is. It's a big challenge. Thank you.
I'm curious how your
Plato
analog works project is addressing past information. So this distributed project. Collaborating with scholars in different disciplines, it strikes me that it is focused on information being produced in the present, correct? But how much does that then engage a process of archiving and perhaps digitization of artifacts, documents that have not yet been part of the record? It suggested to me when you mentioned indigenous histories, etc., that there is the possibility of a kind of information level reparations project that is one that includes previously excluded histories. And so how is your project now engaging that possibility?
Now it includes both. It includes digital, and we continue to, because a lot of material will continue to come to us in an analog format for decades. In fact, it's not, we need to continue to ingest from both channels. What you're talking about is kind of a dream, because I did my dissertation on Aboriginal issues, and I know that there some societies continue to have a prominent oral tradition. And yes, maybe going into documenting society instead of just acquiring and collecting may bring us to expand and as an archive and to make sure that we are a representative. But it's not part of the project yet. But that would be something, I think, that would be
absolutely.
So, No more questions?
I'm also adjunct faculty. And so what should I tell my students? What should I tell them to do? Because we've got my last class coming up. They're all looking for jobs. What should they be doing?
That's a very good question. In fact, that we've been it's not easy. I think they need to come at it with a very open mind, and this is important because there is no answer yet, and to be ready maybe to do a PhD to help us to find solutions into the domain. That'd be I'm pushing some of the schools in Canada to move on with that because we need more research.
In
this old world of how are we going to document society in future? I mean, this would be wonderful, and it calls upon literature. In fact, Eric is from and this is why we're connecting very well, because in the past we've been focusing on organizing documentations coming to us, and that's what probably we're all teaching to our students. So now we need to tell the students, now you need to be involved in the selection. You need to go upstream and help appraise. That's a different and more sensitive, as I said, and dangerous to some extent, activity. But we've got sociology, we've got economy, we've got social sciences that can. So I think people have to move into that direction and expand a little bit above and over. And also in terms of organizing the material, it will be different.
Yes.
Because it's not being accessed the same way, so I would say go in linguistic and find ways to emulate the vocabulary, so the lexicon is a reflection of what society is using, and it's changing rapidly. So you know there are many areas where they can, but you need to come at it with an open mind. So we're no longer in the business of just waiting on the loading dock, so we get the books from the publishers, and we get the phone, the boxes, and so we can just go to our offices and start. It's different. Mm-hmm. So if they come at the job with this mindset, I think they're going to be very helpful. Welcome.
So thanks so much.
Pleasure.